Bhagavatyai Arya Pranya Paramitayai. Homage to the perfection of wisdom. This is about the Diamond Sutra, which after the Heart Sutra is the most chanted and studied of all of the 40 perfect wisdom sutras found in Mahayana Buddhism. It was, however, forgotten in India, little used in Tibet, but completely pivotal in the East Asian Mahayana. In China, it is chanted in many Zen schools and many sutra schools. It was also the first book ever printed. There was a woodcut made in AD 868, and a copy of it was found in the Dunhuang caves in the desert on the Silk Road. So actually a copy of the first book exists. Its popularity in East Asia is due to its succinct summary of the Perfect Wisdom Sutras. We'll try to unpack it a little bit. It starts in the usual manner, thus have I heard at one time the Buddha was in such and so a place, with such and so an assembly. There's a description of the Dharma assembly, and then a praise of the Buddha, and then usually there's a question, a dialogue. Subhuti posits the key question in this case: how should a son or daughter of good lineage who has set out in the bodhisattva vehicle stand? How progress? How control our thoughts? That's similar to the question posed in the Heart Sutra, which is wishing to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, how should a son or daughter of good lineage proceed? And Avalokita's advice there is to view all the five skandhas as empty of essential nature, empty of intrinsic being of any sort. The five skandhas are the process that had already been substituted for the false notion of an ego or a self or a person. And in the Heart Sutra, these processes are also said to be empty of intrinsic nature. Now, in the case of the Diamond Sutra, it's farther up the line. The Bodhisattva is already set out in the Bodhisattva vehicle. And the question is, how should they stand? How should they progress? How should they control their thoughts? And the first thing that anyone in the Bodhisattva vehicle needs to do is to produce what's called the bodhicitta, the thought of enlightenment. And there's a quote there: as many beings as there are in the universe of beings, all these I must lead to nirvana, into that realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And then the sutra goes on to say, and yet from the view of emptiness, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? Because in a Bodhi being, no notion of a self or a being should take place, nor the notion of a living soul or of a person. So this is what they call ultimate bodhicitta. We start with the aspiring bodhicitta. We wish to be of service to other living beings. And we practice in order to be of better service to other human beings. But we usually start out with a limited perspective. And then as we approach the ultimate, we realize, there are really no beings at all. It's all just one emptiness. And so even though all these beings are being led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana, because there are no beings, ultimately. So this wisdom approach to the bodhicitta always reaches for the ultimate, for the infinite, for the beyond. And the next step that a bodhisattva needs to take, having entered the bodhisattva vehicle, is to practice the six perfections. And the six perfections, of course, are a Mahayana version of the Eightfold Path. Not that that makes the Eightfold Path obsolete, it just adds to it. So these six perfections, when they're infused with wisdom, the sixth perfection, then they become empty in a certain way. So to practice the six perfections unsupported by any notion of a doer, an action, or a recipient of an action. The emptiness doesn't differentiate between doers, actions, or recipients of actions. So, in the case mentioned in the sutra, the bodhisattva should give a gift unsupported by sense objects, unsupported by the notion of a sign. And practicing the perfections in this way produces a heap of merit, immeasurable as the extent of space in the ten directions. It being an infinite practice, it has an infinite, immeasurable result. I think I'll go through the six perfections from the point of view of the wisdom approach. Giving, of course, again, no notion of a sign, no notion of a sense object, no notion of a gift, a giver, or the action of giving. Just infinite, empty giving. The second perfection, the perfection of ethical conduct, easiest way is to follow some rule book, like the Pratimoksha vows, the 10 actions to be avoided. We tend to approach ethics in a situational way so that ethical conduct depends entirely on the situation that that we're in. You know, what is unethical in one situation may be ethical in another. But as we get more inspired, we need to practice ethical conduct without any notion of anyone practicing it, anything like a conduct, anything like a beneficiary of ethical conduct. Similarly, a perfection of patience has to be practiced with no notion of a person being patient, a situation, or a person receiving the gift of patience. There's a story in the sutra about the Buddha in a previous life where the king of Kalinga met him in the forest. He was living as a hermit, practicing patience, and the king was on an outing in the forest, and along with his harem and a whole retinue, and the people in his harem discovered this hermit, and they thought that hermit was really cute, what a nice mascot, and so on like that. And they were paying a lot of attention to them. And the king came along and saw what was going on, saw all of his harem flirting with this hermit, who was, and the king got furious, and he took out his sword and he hacked the hermit to pieces. But it is said, because he was practicing ultimate patience, that he had no thought of ill will at the time that that happened. And the reason he had no thought of ill will is he had no thought of a being or a person. And so the situation didn't affect him. You know, he was somehow totally beyond it. Likewise, the perfection of vigor. Again, no notion of a person being vigorous. You know, no notion of the act of a vigorous action. Usually it's said that vigor is primarily the vigor to practice the Dharma. You know, to study sutras, to chant, to meditate, to do devotional service. But again, there's no notion of any of that really taking place, because there's the mind of the bodhisattva practicing vigor or effort is totally empty of any of those kind of thoughts. And being empty of the thoughts, then the action is much more effective. So the corresponding merit is much greater. Yeah, it takes a while to process, but basically the actions are to be done with an empty mind, with a mind that's not cluttered by thoughts of self or thoughts of other, without being limited by thinking entirely. And yet all of these positive acts are still performed. Likewise, perception of perfection of concentration, imbued with wisdom. There's no notion of a person concentrating, no notion of the process of concentration, no notion of an object of concentration, no notion of a result, just pure meditation. And likewise, with the sixth perfection, perfection of wisdom, there's no logic left to perfect. There's no understanding left to perfect. It's just pure wisdom. So those two things, then, a bodhisattva has to practice in order to progress in the bodhisattva vehicle. I should mention bodhi is a word for enlightenment. It means awakening. And sattva means being. So a being who is bent on enlightenment is a bodhi being, a bodhisattva. Okay, then going on, later in the sutra it says the Buddha cannot be recognized by any marks or characteristics. Quote, what has been taught by the Tathagata as a possession of marks, that is truly a no possession of no marks. So there are no signs by which you can recognize an awakened being. Now this Dharma body is the ultimate expression of an awakened being. And this Dharma body is identical with emptiness, or fullness, if you will, because emptiness at that level has no opposite. So it's both fullness and emptiness. You know, it's both zero and infinity at the same time. So this Dharma body can be thought of as the body of the teachings. And again, he brings up the last 500 years, the time of the collapse of the good Dharma. And
is this a legend or a prediction?
It's a prophecy, yes. Yeah, there are said to be five total ages, 500-year ages. The first one was 500 years after the Buddha's teaching. And that was where the cream of the crop was available. You know, and after 500 years, the cream had been used up. They started on the milk. Mm-hmm. And that was the age of what they call the apparent Dharma. You know, it's degenerated a little bit, but it's still Dharma. And then in the next 500 years, there's great activity building temples, building stupas, making statues, doing devotional actions. But the number of people that actually engaged in the Dharma become fewer, as these other activities take over the Dharma practice. But it's still healthy Buddhism. And then, after that 1,000 years, then the Dharma begins to decay further. And at the end of the last 500 years, it's said that the legend has it that a king offers half his kingdom, you know, half his lands and elephants and horses and soldiers and whatever all a king has, for one single four-line stanza of the Good Dharma. And no one can produce it. And at that point, the Good Dharma is quite dead. And then another Buddha comes. And the whole cycle repeats. Maitreya is the next one, yes.
Well, they're talking in this a lot about the four lines. If you can really,
yes,
you know, really understand and really talk about four lines, then you're.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a four-line stanza that pretty much ends the sutra.
Yeah.
And let's have a look at it. Yeah. This is Kanzi's more literal translation. It goes like this. As stars, a fault of vision, as a lamp, a moksha, dewdrops, or a bubble. A dream, a lightning flash or cloud. So should one view what is conditioned. And everything in our experience is conditioned, of course. Mm-hmm. Everything arises from causes and conditions. As for this metaphor, you have to think about each symbol. Stars, they're distant, they're bright in the night, but invisible by day. And there are very many of them, but it's mostly empty space. So similarly, all the events in our world are like stars in that sense. They're mostly empty space. Fault of vision, the usual image is a cataract or a condition of the eyes where you see falling hairs, and there's really no falling hairs there. Likewise, what we make of the conditioned world that we're in is a fault of vision. It's distorted. We distort the reality through our subjective approach. And since we're subjective from a very early age and taught to be subjective, it's hard to break through that single perspective and try to see things in a more objective, more total way. A lamp, okay. The things of the world like a lamp. Lamps in those days were open flames, and they flicker and flicker, and when the fuel runs out, they're gone. Or the wind blows out the flame and it's gone. Similar, any event, no matter how good or how bad, is going to cease in the same way that the lamp, flame of the lamp ceases. A moksha, that's like a magician's mirage. You know, like the cobra dancing or the climbing up of a rope. Mm. It's a sorcerer's trick. So you can think of the world as that, too, as being somehow a bad movie. Dewdrops. Think of a dewdrop. They're wonderful, just as a lot of the experiences in samsara are wonderful. But they're totally ephemeral. Dewdrop is going to evaporate and it'll be gone. A lightning flash, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Again, things pass so fast.
Yeah.
And a cloud, you know, vague, foggy, doesn't seem to have any boundaries, just as events in this world are unclear and don't have any boundaries. I got on a roll writing paraphrases of that four-line stanza, and I'll read a couple of them. All things in this fleeting world are impermanent, full of projected illusion. They are like the reflection of the moon in water, substanceless as an image in a mirror, ephemeral like a rainbow, a lightning flash in a summer cloud, bubbles on the sea. That is how to meditate on them. That is how to observe them. And another one, again, a paraphrase of the same four-line stanza. All composite things of this fleeting world are the phantom of a dream. They are like a bubble in a stream, or froth on the seashore, an illusion of the mind. They are like a star at dawn, a dewdrop in the sunlight. They are like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, the shadow of a dream. And that's all I got for today.
Nice.